Okay, meeting will come to order. This is Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs today on March 14th. And apologize, members, for a late start here. As you know, the Environment Finance Committee was running a little bit over just prior to the start of our meeting here. Let's see. I have a quick announcement here. You know, we have a new committee legislative assistant, Sarah Dernberger, and she has requested that each of you show your little name tag so that she can read it from where she's at. So thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. As you know, we've switched how we do the seating order in this committee. And, okay, today we have five bills. If we run out of time, we'll leave the last couple of bills for tomorrow's meeting. And let's see, you can see the agenda for tomorrow's meeting. It's kind of a military initiative. Thursday will be our pension day, and we'll start with the Minneapolis teachers' pension bill first at 10:15 on Thursday, and then do the other two pension bills, and I think we might have one or two that day as well in addition to that. So as you remember, Thursday night this week is our one evening meeting. We'll go from 6 until 9. And then Friday we'll also be meeting. That was also marked on your original calendar. And on Friday we'll be hearing Representative Kahn's community ownership bill for the twins, and then also Representative Westerberg's bill on the Northern Lights at Blaine, the Vikings bill. So we have a busy week. Today we're 2 weeks out from first deadline, so strap yourself in. We've got a big ride ahead of us here. Thank you, members. Okay. First off, approval of the minutes. Representative Ruth Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the minutes of March 9th.
Thank you. Representative Johnson moves the approval of the minutes of the March 9th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay. First bill up today is House File 2341. Chair moves that House File 2341 be recommended to pass and go to the General Register. And I understand that there's one small technical change, kind of a typo on it. So, Mr. Shepard, where is that small change? Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, members, on page 1, line 24, there's just an incorrect subdivision number. The number should be subdivision 8 instead of subdivision 7.
Okay, and I'll incorporate that change with my motion. Okay, with that, Representative Abrams, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and introduce your colleague there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ron Abrams, State Representative from District 43B, making a return appearance to the home port. Representative Kahn, making a return visit to the home port. I have with me Greg.
Madam Chair, if I can say a word. When Representative Abrams, and as a freshman, served on the committee I chaired, which was then State Government Finance, which was a serious committee in those days. It covered about five of the existing appropriation divisions we now have. At the end of that, he was voted the Freshman Legislator of the Year for his ability to hold his own with that gang of thugs, I think it was called. So,
I was
the
also
first honor is due to me.
I was also voted most detested freshman because I was on the committee representing the town. I have with me Grace Hubinger from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Madam Chair and members, House File 2341 is a housekeeping bill from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. All of these provisions have been through the LCC and subject to discussion. The bill was introduced last year, but for whatever reason, we didn't get around to it, and asked Greg to go through the provisions.
Mr. Hubinger, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm Greg Hubinger with the LCC. As Representative Abrams indicated, this is a housekeeping bill. Section 1 allows the chair of the LCC, which rotates annually between the House and the Senate, to designate another member of the same body to serve as chair in their absence. Section 2 clarifies that the LCC can accept gifts and grants and that those funds are appropriated to the LCC. Section 3 and 4 deal with some obsolete language with the Pensions Commission. Sections 5 through 7 affect the Compensation Council, which, as you know, makes recommendations to the legislature regarding salaries for constitutional officers, judges, and legislators. We're proposing to change the date in which those appointments are made, move them back from October to January 1st to 15th of the even-numbered year, which reflects the common practice that's been followed for the last several years. Section 6 alters the membership of the council somewhat. Instead of having 6 legislators on the council, it would be non-legislators that are appointed by the leadership. And Section 6 also alters the date by which the recommendations are due to be made to the legislature. It moves it up by a month so that the recommendations can be incorporated into the appropriations process. Section 8 clarifies that the chair of the LCC can approve expenses of the Electric Energy Task Force, like the chair can do for all other expenses that are encumbered by the commission. And Section 9 repeals some outdated language and includes the repeal of the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Ontario Matters, which has never been appointed and never met.
Okay, is there questions from members? Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kippinger, I need an explanation in regard to section number 6 relative to the membership, and it says and on the second line indicates who are appointed by the legislators' offices and must be non-legislators. What's the reason for that?
Mr. Hubinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey. I think the idea is to be have them, all the members of the Compensation Council be consistently appointed. Currently, under existing law, only legislators are current office holders. Mm-hmm. All of the other members of that council are non-elected officials, non-constitutional officers. And the idea is to have an outside group making recommendations to the legislature about salaries for all of these positions.
Madam Chair. Follow-up, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, Mr. Kippinger, we've got problems of great magnitude relative to pensions. And is there any criteria for the experience or the background or, let's say, the experiences that the people have had that might be good people on the Compensation Council?
Mr. Kippinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, the council makes recommendations to the legislature about salaries for these elected officials. There's a resulting impact on salary increases on their pensions, but the council doesn't make recommendations about the pensions per se.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Representative Dempsey,
I'm not so concerned as that. My concern is that hopefully it would be people that have a background in the business sector or whatever, management or whatever else the case may be, so that fairness is involved in the situation, experience of these people brings forth, I think, maybe actions that are wise and prudent that they be implemented and so on. And I'm just wondering if there's any criteria that is needed for being a member of this important position. Could you help me with that?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, you're correct that there aren't any criteria about the membership of the council, but the council is required in law to follow a number and consider a number of criteria in making their recommendations, including how these salaries relate to salaries in the private sector to other public positions.
Anything further, Representative Dempsey?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abrams. I'm just kind of curious about this Section 8 in here, and I'm just wondering, I think that one of you had mentioned that this was just letting the chair make this assessment, was just bringing this into conformity with how other assessments are decided or something like that. Could you just explain why this was different in the first place? Was there a reason or was it just an oversight?
Representative Abrams.
Let me give you a little bit of legislative history on the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. When the first Prairie Island bill passed, I believe that that's when the Electric Energy Task Force was created. And it was thought that this group would be meeting a lot and incurring a lot of expenses. And this is an assessment back to the electric generating industry. The practice has been over the years is that the Electric Energy Task Force has not met that often, has not done that much studies. And I've been a member of the LCC during entire existence, and I think that the highest amount of the assessment was about $40,000 one year, but normally much less. And given the infrequency of the times in which the LCC meets, it just seems to me and to the other members of the LCC that we can empower the chair simply to approve it as a as kind of almost a committee expense, and then it gets assessed back to the electric industry. As a practical matter, now, if we were to follow the letter of the law, we would literally have to have an annual meeting of the LCC with that simply on the agenda. It is a big year for the LCC if we meet twice.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Representative Liebling?
No, Madam Chair.
Next up, Representative Wardlaw.
This is a small question. Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 2, Subdivision 7, regarding grants, do you have you experienced or do you foresee any possibility of someone granting money to the Commission to be used for specified services?
Mr. Hibbinger.
Influencing the Commission at all in some way, or is that a possibility? Or?
Mr. Hibbinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlaw, in the last couple of years, the LCC received a grant on behalf of the legislature to publicize and promote charter schools. And in order to process that grant, we needed to follow a process that is established in the executive branch, which was quite cumbersome for a legislative office. There were a couple of other members of the LCC that have been suggesting other possibilities for grants that would improve educational programs for the legislature. And so it was thought that we should try to streamline the process of accepting funds.
Okay. Next up, for CENTCON.
Yes. Madam Chairman, I'm interested in this Office of Legislative Research. I get it's one of the first to appeal. I'm interested in why, you know, particularly now when we're talking about trying to have more cooperation, why it's never been used, and what's and why we need to repeal it.
Mr. Hibbinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, as I understand it, this language was adopted in the early 70s and was tried for a year or two where there was a joint research office between the House and the Senate, and leadership in both bodies concluded that it wasn't working very well, and so they ended the experiment. It hasn't been used since. All the offices now have separate appropriations and separate offices with separate management. My sense is that even though there's been some discussion about sharing exploring the idea of sharing of services, we're not sure that this language would be helpful in going down that road.
Follow up, Representative Kahn.
Well, the office, the revised statutes, and the legislative reference library are under the LCC. So, is that done separately then?
Mr. Hibbinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, yes, they received their appropriations directly in the state government finance bill.
Anything further?
Oh, yes.
Representative Kahn.
The expenses, if you're not allocating them, how are they going to be allocated?
Mr. Hibbinger.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, there's a separate provision in Chapter 3 that allows the LCC to transfer appropriations amongst the joint offices and between the House and the Senate if there's approval by leadership.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay, is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, Representative Abrams, you get the final word before we vote here. Representative Abrams.
A simple housekeeping bill, Madam Chair.
Okay.
It will make the order just a little bit better.
Okay.
Oh, we have a question. Representative Kahn.
Well, we thought we might give Representative Abrams an experience he has probably never had in his entire legislative career, which was to move the bill to the consent calendar. Is that
be a first, Madam?
Let's try it.
Okay.
maybe we'll just knock it off just to show them. But
okay.
It would be a question is which caucus would do it. I'd move it.
Okay, I'm going to withdraw my earlier motion and
I'll
then
just amend yours.
Okay, sounds good. Any questions? Okay, so the motion is to that House File 2341, as corrected, be recommended to pass on the consent calendar in the House of Representatives. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and going to the consent calendar. Thank you, Representative Abrams.
I said I'm not for this caucus. Which caucus has for the sentiment ticket?
Okay, Representative Abrams has the next bill up, which is House File 2368. Chair will move that. Chair will move that House File 3268 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee. And I see that there's an A1 amendment. Representative Abrams, would you like to put that on the bill to put it in the order you'd like?
I would, Madam Chair, and when I go through the bill, I'll explain why the A1 amendment was necessary.
Okay. Chair moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Abrams, your bill is before us as amended.
Madam Chair, I don't think that this is going to be consent calendar material, but I think it is. I think it is an important, probably one of the most important initiatives of the 2006 legislative session. Madam Chair and members, House File 3268 provides a framework for bioscience research funding, bioscience research facilities on the University of Minnesota. To kind of cut to the chase, there would be $340 million worth of bonding authority, which would be triggered by a number of events, as President Brunig will outline. Biomedical sciences is one of those in which you have to be somewhat forward-thinking in being able to get into this business. The idea that we can come to the legislature on an annual or biannual basis and say that we have a state policy regarding research and development in the biosciences simply doesn't cut water. As President Brunig will talk about in trying to get researchers to the University of Minnesota, it's not just a researcher who comes. The researcher brings a team. It can be anywhere from 5 to 20 members on a team. And they will be applying for large grants from a variety of institutions. You have to have new lab space built to specifications and being able to house these people. What House File 3268 says is that the university can go recruit knowing that there isn't going to be a space crunch in the future. Why is this bill before the Government Operations Committee? The bill establishes a Bioscience Research Facilities Authority, which consists of 9 members, the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, 4 other non-executive branch appointees by the governor, and 4 members of the House and the Senate appointed by leadership in the same ways in which these are appointments are normally handled. The 4 legislators, upon advice by the Attorney General on separation of powers, have to be non-voting. And we asked bond counsel at the Attorney General's office, you would have a separation of powers problem if you delegated a executive branch decision to this group. The terms are staggered 4-year terms. I will now ask President Brunings to give his presentation. I wanted to give you that as kind of a background. And this is a big idea and an important idea, and I would hope that members of the committee would have lots of questions so that we can try to fix it. Oh, one other issue that may change by the time this gets to the floor in some way. For those who remember the Cambridge bank bonds, the funding mechanism is similar to the Cambridge bank bonds in that it is going to take some general fund monies and dedicate it to the revenues, to the revenue stream without additional appropriation. Right now it's basically the general fund. Before this gets to the floor, there will be a identifiable revenue source. One idea is the ongoing tobacco payments, which go on forever. But we are going to identify a revenue source so that they more closely resemble the Cambridge bank bonds rather than the general fund language that's in Section 6.
President Brunings, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Kingelstead, members of the committee, thank you to Representative Abrams for giving us this opportunity and making the introduction to what I think is one of the more exciting ideas we've advanced in many, many years. I'd like to also take a moment to introduce Deborah Powell, who is behind me and serves as Dean of the University of Minnesota Medical School. And if we have sufficient time, I would like her to comment on the special challenges that are involved in maintaining a vibrant biosciences research capacity at the University of Minnesota. Well, I think, as Senator Abrams mentioned, this is a critical part of Minnesota's infrastructure. It's not an option to be a participant in the biosciences today, and it's certainly not an option for the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is a leader today in the biomedical sciences and medical devices and in the healthcare industry. This is an industry in the aggregate that has more than 500 businesses in Minnesota. And support organizations, they employ over 250,000 people each and every year. We have world-leading companies in the biomedical devices area, just to name one sector of the biosciences industries that we're going to talk about today. Firms like Medtronic, a firm started by University of Minnesota Research, Guidant, Boston Scientific, 3M is a major player in biomedical sciences, and a strong partner of the University of Minnesota in many research areas, St. Jude Medical, and I could go on and name many, many others. This is a sector that not only has established Minnesota as a world leader, but it's also an area that has witnessed or seen a phenomenal employment growth. The employment growth in this sector of Minnesota's economy has grown about 32%. In the past 10 years compared to about a 10% national average in employment growth. I'd like to argue, and I think it's an undisputed fact, that the University of Minnesota is integral to the state's future in the biomedical sciences. We have invested hundreds of millions of dollars to remain competitive in this area thanks to strong and generous support from the state of Minnesota, our own internal reallocations, and also the federal government. This is a place that is the university in which people will bring in this year nearly $570 million in competitive grants and contracts, over $300 million of which, that is dollars, will come from the National Institutes of Health alone in this particular area of health-related biosciences. That's 98 cents of every dollar brought in through competitive grants and contracts into Minnesota's system of public and private higher education. We think we're on the right track. We think we're making many of the right decisions, right investments, through partnerships with Mayo, through our own work. But as Will Rogers once said, even if you think you're going in the right direction, you can get run over if you just sit there. And I think our problem and the challenge facing Minnesota is, do we really want to be continue to be a world competitive place where people do research, discover new ideas, take those ideas into Minnesota's economy, or do we want to try to coast and sit out what I think is going to be one of the world's most exciting healthcare and economic revolutions? So why is this important? Why are we bringing to you at this time with all the various problems and issues that you have to deal with, all the competing interests? Why are we bringing this particular idea with what looks like a 10-year long-term price tag? Let me give you some simple, what I think straightforward explanations. First of all, you cannot compete in this area with the normal approach we use to bonding projects in the state of Minnesota. These are projects that are technologically complex, that take a long time to develop, and they take a long-term commitment and a long-term horizon. I think of this more as a part of the state's infrastructure rather than an occasional capital investment. Secondly, we absolutely need to make investments on a long-term basis in this area if we want to be globally competitive and we want to be one of the most competitive states in the United States. Thirdly, we need to do this so that we can maintain and increase the amount of funding that comes into Minnesota to fund vitally important research and development in this essential area. And then finally, we need to do this, we need to make these investments so that we can encourage, support, and provide the necessary infrastructure to transfer what we discover through technology into Minnesota's economy. I should give you one quick sidebar fact. There's a magazine, an international magazine, that evaluates research universities, more than 600 of them across the globe, on the extent to which they have promising technologies in their pipeline. That is, ideas that look like they have some potential to create the Medtronics of the future. And in a recent analysis and study, the New Scientist magazine estimated that the University of Minnesota was the fourth most promising intellectual property pipeline of any university in the United States. And so I think that's another reason why this is so important and so important to Minnesota's future. Now, why does the university need this kind of help at the present time? First of all, we need to expand our faculty in this area. In order to expand faculty, recruit faculty, and keep faculty in this globally competitive marketplace, we need technologically sophisticated research space, a space that is necessary to conduct the research that I'll talk just briefly about today. And I mentioned we also need, as a university, if we're going to keep the university among the very best in the country, in the world, we obviously need to maintain our research funding, and I would argue we need to increase it. Why is it important for Minnesota to even care about this? We're doing relatively well. If you look at the biomedical sciences industries and health-related industries in Minnesota. One of my colleagues, in doing an analysis, Tim Mulcahy, said the images in the rearview mirror just may be closer than you think. And this map says the images in the rearview mirror are nipping at the heels of the state of Minnesota. This map shows states that are making very deep investments, capital investments, if you will, in the biomedical sciences. Iowa to the south has something called the Iowa Values Fund. It's focusing $700 million on economic development initiatives. A big portion of this will be dedicated to biomedical science research in their various universities. To our east, Wisconsin has a $750 million short-term initiative, $570 million of which will be dedicated precisely to advancing capital investment in this area. Virginia is not considered to be a major player like the University of Minnesota is today. They're spending more than $500 million in this area to jumpstart and support their work and to make them more competitive in this area. Indiana has a 1.5 million square foot investment they plan to make in the biomedical sciences, probably located mostly in Indianapolis. In short, what these states are doing is developing a long-term, predictable plan for building the core, for maintaining and building the core infrastructure that is necessary to compete in this critically important area. And I would point out that Minnesota already has a position of leadership in this area, but it's a position we can very, very quickly lose. So what does this plan really include? Representative Abrams gave you a quick preview. This plan would span a 10-year period. It would allow the university to construct or remodel up to 5 major buildings in the next 10 years. Each of these buildings would house 40 new faculty members. Each faculty member comes with additional research staff, usually estimated at about 3 per faculty member. This would create 800 new jobs in just the research sector of Minnesota. Why is this a good investment? The average researcher that we hire in this area, on average, receives annual grant awards that are part of Minnesota's positive balance of payments of nearly $400,000 a year. So if you assume one new award for each of the 40 faculty members, which I think is a relatively modest and safe assumption, that's $20 million in new grant awards per year into each of these 5 buildings. So I haven't calculated the exact return on investment, but I think you can see just from this sketch of the numbers that it would be very, very substantial. The total cost of this proposal, adjusted for inflation and assuming approximately 150,000 gross square feet per building, would be about $366 million over the next 10 years, about $73 million per building. I should mention that in the recent capital bonding bills, it has taken roughly 6 to 8 years to get 2 such buildings constructed at the University of Minnesota. In the usual bonding cycle, like in the last one, for example, there were only 3 buildings that exceeded $30 million. So I think one of the things we need to remember is that to compete in this area does really cost money, and the capital investments have to be on a larger scale than what we're used to funding and used to considering in the normal capital cycle. Now, how would this operate? Representative Abrams gave you a sense of how the authority would be structured and how the appointments would be made. It would be an entity of the state. The state would authorize $330 million in general obligation debt to support the program. The debt wouldn't be front-loaded. It would be done over a 10-year period. The university would share in the cost of the projects. 10% of the capital cost, according to the bill, would be a university responsibility. All the operating costs, and the operating costs on these technologically sophisticated facilities is considerable. All of that would be on the university's side of the ledger. We would not be coming to the state for operating cost help. We might come to the state for academic investments in the future as a part of our normal biennial request. Statutory transfer of funds on a schedule sufficient to service the debt would be a part of this plan, and a proposal would be brought forward every 2 years for the consideration of this authority as a part of the plan we are presenting. It's a predictable plan. It allows the state to plan and the university to plan for, I think, an even stronger future in this area. It allows us to be, I think, much more competitive. I think one of the reasons we're coming here with a dollar amount that is lower than the examples I gave you is because this state has been smart, and our legislature and our executive branches have funded the University of Minnesota, I think, at a better level than, I think, some other states. I mentioned the difficulties of planning under the current bonding cycle. The next graph I'll go through very, very quickly. A schematic shows how the authority would actually work. If successful, at least this year, the Minnesota legislature would take action and the governor would sign the bill, creating the Minnesota Biomedical Sciences Authority. I'm working off the left-hand side of this chart. It would establish the program. It would authorize $330 million of general obligation debt and establish a dedicated source of funding in the state treasury to make these payments. and it would enact a statutory transfer of incremental percent of state tax revenue to service the bonds. And if you need to know exactly what that means, I have Richard Fitzenreiter with me here this morning, and he can answer more detailed questions. On the right-hand side of the diagram, what would the authority do? It would accept the applications in accordance with the goals and objectives in the program and contained in the proposed legislation. It would approve financing for the projects. You see the formula that I mentioned just a moment ago, with 90% of the cost from the state, 10% of the cost of the capital cost coming from the university and university resources, and all the operating costs would be on the university side of the ledger. In the lowest box, right-hand box, you see the revenue transfer schedule, the estimated revenue transfer schedule. In 2008-09, it would be $4.3 million per year. And after 2016, for the duration of the bonds, it would be approximately 26.4. But I should mention that the longer you go out, the more the payments decline. So they reach a peak and then begin to decline once again as you go past 2016. Well, anyway, that is the end of my very quick overview of what I think is a very exciting and creative idea to keep Minnesota on the map and to keep us competitive in this vitally important area for the University of Minnesota. We have a couple of minutes, Chair Tingle said. I would like Dean Powell just to give you a sense of what it takes to recruit and maintain very, very talented faculty members in this area.
Dean Powell, welcome to the committee, and please present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. The medical school at the University of Minnesota brings in over a third of the research dollars that come to the university. And three schools together, medicine, the Institute of Technology, and public health, bring in over two-thirds of the research dollars. So the medical school, I think, is critical to the research success of the university and the economic development in biomedical sciences of the state. We're having a tough time because we need to recruit absolutely the best faculty. And we are successful occasionally, and we lose more than we get. We want to bring in the top talent. We were recently successful, and you probably saw in the paper in the School of Pharmacy, of bringing a medicinal chemist from the University of Kansas, Gunda Georg. She will be in charge of drug design and drug development. This takes the translational research that we do in our labs and moves it into preparation for clinical trials in patients. So this is the direct pipeline that we need, and we're very excited about that. But just this past week, I lost a recruit from Johns Hopkins and one from Dartmouth. And this is challenging because what I have to do, since our research space in our beautiful two new buildings that took 8 years to get is now used up, I have to say, we will build you something like this. Look and see what we have. But I have nothing right now to show them. So it's very challenging. It's about people, and it's about facilities, and it's about predictability. To be able to bring in people, to show them the plan, to show them the space, and to assure them that their careers will flourish in Minnesota. As the president said, an average grant to the medical school is about $400,000, but our expectation for faculty is that they will have a minimum of two grants. And we have many investigators who have five or more grants. And we want to recruit the five or more category. So this is really essential to the future of the medical school, and I think the future of biomedical sciences in Minnesota. And it's a very exciting time for Minnesota and for everyone in biomedical sciences. I think this is truly the next medical device industry. So I'm very excited about this proposal because I think it means so much to the medical school and the university and to the state.
Thank you, Dean Powell. Before we get to questions, I just have a quick announcement. We have guests today. They're members of the Minnesota Literacy Council from St. Paul, so let's welcome them. Okay, questions from members. Representative Kahn.
Okay. I have a comment and then about three questions. The first comment is that, of course, I'm glad to see this expanded university interest in biomedical research. That's what I was before I got into the legislature, and the reason I ran for the legislature was that in applying for the renewal of the grant I had for the American Cancer Society, member of the university administration made me cut it from 2 years to 1 year because I had filed a discrimination complaint against the university. So it's always nice to see the university's not as interested in throwing free money away. And plus the fact that, well, you people can realize you've been stuck with me with all these years because of that one guy.
I don't think I would have done that. Let's see how it goes this session.
Okay. The second issue, and maybe I see it, is, you know, I understand, obviously, why you want to do this, but, you know, I'm just a little nervous about setting something in free fall without any legislative oversight along the way, and I almost think I see a place where that could happen, but I'm a little concerned about how much, you know, suppose you're doing these one buildings every 2 years and they're not, you know, you're having problems getting people to come for various reasons, you know, things like they're running into the new Bill of Representative Heidegger, so you can't get anyone who doesn't speak Minnesotan English to come, and those sorts of, you know, if you're looking at joint faculty appointments. So I'd like to see something that has some legislative oversight in it. I think I'll just put everything out at once, and then you can answer what you want. The next issue, and that's the problem about why I don't like these bills starting in GovOps. I think they should start somewhere else. I think the issue of fund structure ought to be a GovOp issue, and the issue of or a state government finance issue. And so we're not even seeing the fund structure in this. We're told that that's coming some point later in the point, and I don't know if that means the bill will come back to government operations after we see that fund structure, but I'm, you know, I really think that that's a fundamental function of government that we should look at. And the next thing that I'd like to do, Representative Abrams, this really looks like a good bill to stick my, as an amendment, my bill to fund stem cell research. Would you like me to do that?
Representative Abrams.
Let me take these in order, Representative Tom. On the legislative oversight issue, there is a legitimate separation of powers issue if you have legislators on the authority that approves.
I don't want that. I agree with that amendment.
And so, first, it's a question of accountability. The first layer of accountability is that there are four non-voting members on that authority. The second layer of oversight is that the University of Minnesota, I think, maybe at the legislature every year looking for money in some manner, way, shape, or form. One of the oversight functions I would suggest that both the House and the Senate would do under those circumstances is say, we gave you this authority, how are you using it? How are you doing? And it would be a very transparent process simply because the authority is public. The decision to go forward is public, and the university will have to publicly defend its decisions through the legislative process, as well as the executive branch under this. Second, as to fund structure, this bill is going to have to make a number of stops. It's going to have to go to the Higher Education Committee. It may have to go to the Jobs Committee because of the Commissioner of Economic Development. It probably, once the fund structure has been determined, have to at least go to taxes, if not back to state government finance. And because it is ongoing capital authority, it's going to have to go to the Capital Investment Committee, let alone the Ways and Means Committee. This is, for members of this committee, this is not the first, or this is not the last time you are going to see this bill. I would suspect that there are some people in this room who are going to see this bill three or four more times. On the stem cells, this bill is tough enough
as it is, Representative Kahn. If there's many more logs on this bill, I'm afraid that we're not going to be able to push the wagon through the snow.
Well, Representative Kahn.
Well, no, then maybe, you know, isn't stem cell, from everything that I've read, and I kind of read Science Weekly, and I, you know, probably spend a lot more attention looking at the literature than some of the other members, at least of this committee and the legislature. Isn't this considered to be the foremost area of biomedical research?
Jean Paul.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. I do believe clearly that stem cell research and regenerative medicine, reparative medicine, is a very exciting avenue. The University of Minnesota is one of the leaders in stem cell research in this country, as you know, and we do research now using state and federal funds, using adult stem cells, some of which were discovered at the University of Minnesota, and approved stem cell lines. We do some embryonal stem cell research, but we are very careful not to use any state or federal money for that, as is allowed. This is, I think, one of the areas which probably will lead to some of the most exciting advances in heart disease and neuroscience, brain disease, spinal cord injury. And we do this. The new building that the legislature funded, the McGuire Translational Research Building, houses the Stem Cell Institute, where we have a number of investigators doing this. So we are committed to doing this at the University of Minnesota and expand it into research in diabetes and liver disease and kidney disease.
Representative Kahn.
You know, but you did lose your most prominent stem cell researcher who did leave, and I certainly remember her coming to the legislature, and, you know, and we were so pleased that she was here.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. Yes, Catherine Verfey, who's the first director of the Stem Cell Institute, has not yet left the university. She will stay as a part-time faculty member, but is moving to Leuven in Belgium, her home, where she will direct the Stem Cell Institute there. We have an affiliation with Leuven. We are currently engaged in a search for a director of the Stem Cell Institute. We have had a number of candidates in. One from Britain is coming back for a second visit. You understand that this is an extremely competitive time, and candidates are going to California. They're going to New Jersey. Part of the reason why I think being able to bring in colleagues, because it's not just stem cell research, it's the other colleagues that work with them, the imagers who see where the stem cells go, the people in clinical trials. Those are very important colleagues. You don't do stem cell research in a vacuum. So we need to bring in more and more people to support the Institute. But we're in actively recruiting right now. And one of the reasons we're able to recruit, I think, is because we had a building where we housed the Stem Cell Institute. But that building is now filled up. Catherine's space will go to the new director.
Okay, next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and guests. I just want to say that I am really behind and fully appreciate the need to go forward with more bioscience, and I think I understand what is the motivator behind this, and that is, of course, the need to move quickly and respond to conditions and how difficult it is to be a public university and have to deal with the cumbersome legislative process. So, you know, I fully support the idea of speeding that up and being able to be more responsive to the market, as it were, and to be competitive in that respect. And actually, Representative Abrams, I'm really glad to hear you kind of recite the litany of committees that this is going to, because my first sort of reaction to it is a huge new idea. And I have to say that it makes me a little bit nervous to be hearing about it kind of for the first time and thinking that I have to make some enormous decisions kind of in a quick way on relatively little knowledge. So I have a lot of questions about this, and I guess the first one, Representative Abrams, would be just have you spell out a little bit more what exactly you feel this committee is looking at today, which part of this should we be looking at, and maybe maybe Chair Tingle said, and Representative Kahn will help flesh that out for us, and then maybe that'll help frame my subsequent questions a little bit better.
Representative Abrams, do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, members, I really believe that there is a new authority that's being created in the bill. And if you look at the House rules, whenever a new governmental authority is established, it has to go through the Government Operations Committee. I think that is kind of the issue that I think is before you. But in order to understand that issue, we had to spend probably more time than you'd like on exactly what this authority was going to do and what the need for the authority is. So I think that the real issue before the committee today is the authority and the structure of the authority. Understanding that the bill, because it's going to rely on dedicated funds and set up a couple funds, probably is going to have to go to the State Government Finance Committee at some point.
Members, that would be Section 3 on pages 2 and 3. Representative Liebling, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that explanation, and that does help, but even so, I hope you'll indulge me with some questions then that don't actually pertain to the decisions that this committee has to make, but I just feel the need to ask. One of them is that this is such a huge new idea, and I have heard a lot this session and over the past few months about universities' various bond requests and certainly the requests having to do with the Gopher Stadium, but I haven't heard anything about this. And I'm just, is that because I'm out of the loop, or is it because, I'm just kind of curious about that, because this is certainly the most momentous thing that I've heard the university asking about in recent times.
President Brunix.
Chair Tingle said, Representative Liebling, members of the committee, no, you haven't been out of the loop. This is a new idea. And it's a new idea that I think is prompted by a growing realization of what it takes to compete in a global marketplace in the area of biomedical sciences. So that's one point that I would make. Second point I would make, this is a big idea, and it carries a big price tag. When you look down the barrel, and it's $330 million, a state obligation over the next 10 years. But there is tremendous accountability built into this system. You have to take the proposal through the authority every 2 years, and you better take a pretty good story with you. That is a story of accomplishment and accomplishing the last building and making sure that you recruited the people to work in that building. You have the obligation to make sure that the state's investment that is leveraged in very powerful ways, that is, the state should get a phenomenal return on investment in this area, not only with respect to federal grants and contracts, but I would also argue with respect to foundation grants and contracts that fund significant work in this area, partnerships with the private sector, the leveraging of partnerships of the kind that we're working on with Mayo and Rochester. I mean, there ought to be a good substantive record behind every request that's made through this authority over the next 10 years. And if the record doesn't materialize, I think we can take care of Speaking Minnesota. We've got that done. We've got a whole program on that. But I'm not too worried about our ability to succeed because people like to go. They like to go and work in a university that already has a strong historical record in this area. And they like to go and work in a state that enjoys the quality of life that Minnesota presents to its citizens. So we have an extraordinary advantage in this area right now, given the vibrancy of the biomedical devices and medical care industries in Minnesota, given the strength of the University of Minnesota and its history of accomplishment in this area, given the smart investments that I think we've made over roughly the last 8 to 9 years, and given your history of support. Without the history of support of the Minnesota legislature and the executive branch in supporting the university's research mission, we wouldn't be in the kind of competitive position that we find ourselves in today. This is all about making sure that we can stay the course and really strengthen our future. But it is a big idea, and it is an idea that is roughly, from our point of view, only about 6 to 8 months old, because we were trying, I'll be honest with you, this was this idea developed in a out of a 2 to 3 day retreat. Actually, it was about 4 or 5 days in two different sessions. And we had the whole wall of one, the dining room of Eastcliff, papered with the 6 to 10 year horizon with respect to capital projects. We looked at it and said, the university simply can't make it with this model. It won't work. And it seems to me that we have the obligation, when we think something won't work, and we think the strategy we have will put the long-term interests of the university and the state in serious jeopardy, we have an obligation to educate the public on these issues, to put the issues on the table, and to debate them to the best of our ability. And these are tough issues because you have to make difficult calls each and every day. But we will never, and I mean never, solve the health care cost problem in this country. We will never be able to advance the health of our population unless we really invest in these critically important areas. Give you one example or two. In this next building that needs to be built, one that is in our capital request and could be shifted from that capital request into this authority should it be funded, there is at least one what is called BSL-3 lab. That allows the researchers at the University of Minnesota to do very, very sensitive and protected research on infectious diseases. Is avian flu a real risk to the global health of the world's population? Absolutely, it is. And we can't compete, for example, very effectively for a $35 million five-year Center for Disease Control grant. Is that right? Mm-hmm. It's going in this month. Unless we commit ourselves in advance to enhancing our capacity in this area. So that just gives you one example where if you want to, and we have the faculty to compete for this grant. We should be in the top echelons when the scores are given on our grant. So the quality will be there in the grant, but the infrastructure to support the work is something that we have to do. We've made a commitment to solve that problem no matter what happens to this authority, simply because we can't afford to pass this opportunity by. But it is a big idea, but it is a relatively recent idea. It's an innovation that we think is in keeping with the sort of creative spirit of our state and the willingness of our state to look long-term rather than short-term. But it is a hard thing to kind of swallow in one session. It truly is.
President Brunick, thank you for those words. And as you were talking about that, I'm just thinking in my 10 years here at the legislature, it's kind of a rare moment that we see bills like this. And I know we have a lot of first-term legislators on this committee. I'm thinking this is one of those visionary, historic bills, and I'm honored to see Representative Abrams carrying it. But this is something that you'll probably look back in your career and say, I was in a room when we talked about this. So I just really applaud you for your vision and looking ahead for this. Representative Liebling, I know you have further questions. Yes. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to try not to monopolize this, but I echo what you just said, Madam Chair. I feel very excited to be hearing about this, I have to say. I think it's just fantastic. And actually, I got a chance to tour the Department of Health labs last night. And so I'm recently familiar with some of what's going on, and it is really fantastic stuff. And these are opportunities that we absolutely cannot afford to miss. But going back to the more mundane piece of this that this committee is supposed to be dealing with, I'll just ask my final question, although I have lots and lots of others. I could probably talk about this all day or hear about it all day. But do other states have anything that's analogous to what we're talking about here, or is this just a really innovative idea in terms of the structure of what you're trying to do?
President Brunick.
Chair Tingelstad, Representative Liebling, I can't tell you exactly how each of the states has structured their authority, but if you take the California Stem Cell Initiative, it's a $3 billion long-term investment. A good deal of that will go into capital projects. So every one of these state initiatives will have some process by which they will vet the proposals and set the priorities for long-term expenditure of funds. And this bill does the same thing. It makes sure that there is regular accountability built into the proposal process and the review process with the authority and, as Representative Abrams has pointed out, through the normal legislative process. And it sets criteria for eligibility that are, I think, the kinds of criteria that ought to be established. So every one of these investments has some mechanism, you know, but some of them, for example, in Wisconsin, when Blue Cross Blue Shield went from nonprofit to private, they had to divest their reserves, and they dedicated, what, $750 million to this area of research. So every state has a, some states have used the lottery to fund these investments. So every state will have a different strategy, but in the middle of it, there will be some kind of proposal process, some kind of review process, some kind of accountability process. And typically, for example, in California, this is a bonding initiative, and so there will have to be a sharing of a public and private costs to make sure the program is successful. So the components of this bill may be somewhat more rigorous than I think you'll find in many other states, and in terms of its architecture and its operation. But I think all of them will have something very, you know, have ingredients that are very similar to what we're talking about.
Thank you. Okay, I have three other members with questions. Next up, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abrams and President Brunick. I want to reframe the discussion because I serve on the Bioscience Division of Commerce, as does Representative Liebling and Representative Severson, and we've heard a lot about the opportunities available both in the private sector as well as in the university. But I think that's the purview of other committees. I really think here we are being presented with a historical precedent that we should not just lightly pass on because the use of it looks interesting, intriguing, and worthwhile. And that is to give away $330 million of bonding authority to an independent group outside of all of our regular processes. This is an incredible precedent. And I think we ought to be debating and spending our hearing time on that issue of should we or should we not set a precedent of someone else having bonding authority, and then does the authority as it's defined in this bill have what's required in terms of public accountability, membership, those sorts of issues. And I think that if we could spend most of our time talking about that and trust the other committees to work on the other issues, I think we can probably get to what we're expected to do. And that's no offense to the presentation, but I really do feel like we need to kind of focus on that, because I think this kind of no strings or low strings kind of process would be desirable to Minsky. It would be desirable to, you know, to have a pool of funds that they could make their own decisions on. We have spent, I can't imagine how many hours debating LCMR and what the proper balance of legislative, administrative, citizen input ought to be on probably less than $50 million a year. And so I think we ought to talk about it in those contexts. One, to me, is the question of the precedent of having some bonding authority given to an independent organization and how that will impact us, even in terms of how we're viewed by the bond houses. I wrote the first debt policy for Minneapolis many years ago and talked with the bond houses, and I'm not sure what they would think of having, you know, sort of this independent authority. We've talked about a realistic limit of 3% debt service, about $900 million max for a total bonding package. This would potentially add another $330 million. My understanding of the bond houses is that they're going to look at everything you're obligated to as a state, not just your little package that you put through here. They're going to look at everything we add on, whether it's the stadiums, whether it's this, whether it's other things. And Representative Abrams, could you address whether or not this is indeed a precedent in terms of how we would delegate bonding authority, and whether or not you've talked with anyone in finance or elsewhere about whether this would have an impact on the bond community's assessment?
Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'm sure Dick Fitzenreiter from the U has had conversations with the Department of Finance, but I, like you, spend a lot of my, at least legislative time, thinking about public finance problem or issues. And if I understand the bond houses correctly, until you actually go to issue the paper, this will not count against the 3% simply because the paper is not outstanding. So I'm not really concerned at that level. Secondly, when you take a look, secondly, in order to directly answer your question, is this a precedent? Yes, it is a precedent. And, you know, I'm happy to stand up and say, yes, it is, and here are the reasons why it's different. It's different from MinSKU. It is different from most of the mission of the University of Minnesota in its teaching mission, because what we're talking about here is research and development infrastructure in the biomedical sciences in order to be able to compete, to have the researchers come to Minnesota to develop a variety of hopefully scientific breakthroughs. Why don't I have Mr. Fitzenreiter directly answer your questions about the public finance issues, but again, at least it's my understanding that until you go to issue the paper, the bond houses will not look at, well, you can come back and issue that. When you come back and issue paper that would exceed the 3% maximum, at that point the rating agencies will take that into effect. The other thing about the 3%, and I'm really talking out of turn here, that has developed almost a mythology around itself that really maybe is 1980-ish. What the bond houses are looking at is the total amount of your debt versus the total amount of your income and the track record of the issuing authority to repay the instruments. And the 3% or the amount of debt service is an indicator that the bond houses will examine. It is certainly not the only one, nor is that applied in a machine-like fashion any longer. It may have been true 20 years ago. It is simply not, I think, the case today. But Mr. Fitzenreiter can probably give
Mr.
you more of an answer.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota. We put up on the screen a slide in anticipation of this question, and it relates to what the state's debt management policy guidelines are. And Representative Abrams alluded to it and certainly mentioned the very first guideline up there, and they are guidelines. The one that everybody hangs their hat on is the general fund. Remember, it's fund-specific. Appropriation for debt service shall not exceed 3% of non-dedicated revenues. Now, you can debate whether this particular bill applies to that guideline or not. That's a debate. But these are, for the record, these are, just like trunk highway bonds, are general obligations of the state. These bonds are general obligations of the state, and the proposal is not out to circumvent the 3% guideline or circumvent any of the debt management policies of the state. The bond houses, when they go to rate the state on a bond issue, will rate this along with any other bonds that are issued at that time. As Representative Abrams said, the first building out of the chute here in this proposal would definitely be in the mix and part of the rating that the agencies give.
We have several other members with questions. Representative Blocker, a quick follow-up.
I'll raise a couple other issues because I know that because we spent so much time on other things, we're going to run out of time here to deal with what I think we need to deal with. I do think the bond houses, at least in the past, used to look at your obligations for the future and ask about your future needs. And if we get into a situation of like we were a few years ago with a massive deficit and a need to potentially scale back, that 3% of the total tends to scale back as well. I'm concerned about the makeup of the authority. We're putting $330 billion of bonding decisions outside of 201 legislators' decisions into 9 people, where it would take 5 then to authorize the sale of these bonds. That seems to me like a pretty small group of people. And I don't see, there's 4 legislators, 5 governor appointees, and I don't see any definition of sort of the background they would have to have, the addressing issues like conflict of interest. I think in one of the bills that came before us earlier, they were members were defined as a public official, so they would be required to disclose things and avoid, you know, appropriately avoid conflicts of interest. And it seems to me like in the makeup of this, there needs to be a fair amount more work in terms of who these people are, who they're accountable to, and how we avoid conflicts of interest. And the last thing I think is I haven't heard a discussion of whether or not you evaluated other ways to speed up our capital bonding process for handling these sorts of opportunities. I understand this is a 10-year plan. And I'm thinking that maybe if we give it a try, if you're expecting this to be five buildings take a long time to acquire land, site acquisition, design, build up. I don't know that we need to approve a 10-year plan at this point. Maybe this could be more viewed as a pilot authority with a lesser dollar amount and a better way of us working through something new. And would really think that we need to, as a committee, do some work on the makeup in terms of the number of people, the backgrounds that they bring to the decision, and their accountability to the public so that the public feels like this is a good organization for us to entrust some pretty big decision-making.
President Brunix.
Chair Tingelstad, Representative Loeffler, you raised some very good questions. I'd like to just address a couple of them. One is that the land for siting these buildings is already held by the University of Minnesota, or if we were in a partnership, let's say with through Rochester, as we did in a capital bill some time ago with Mayo Clinic, that land was held by the Mayo Clinic, and but the building on the land is in the inventory of the University of Minnesota. Secondly, this is a long-term commitment for something that is going to probably be a major commitment of the state for 100 years, not just 10 years. And this is not a flash-in-the-pan investment. This is an investment that we know is going to carry this state for a long, long period of time and be a part of the state's responsibility. Thirdly, we have done similar things, as I understand it, in the past. We have a housing finance authority, you know, and so we've bonded like this to do core infrastructure for sewers and roads. And I would view this as a decision of whether it makes sense for Minnesota to make this kind of long-term investment. And if it does, is this the right mechanism to do it, which is where I think you're driving your question. Now, with respect to the regular bonding process and why that can't accommodate something of this extraordinary nature, I'll just simply say that in putting together the university's bonding bill, it's a bill that covers about 28 million assignable square feet of space that we manage and operate throughout the state of Minnesota. It's an inventory with the oldest buildings, you know, mostly in the state. At least 50% of them are 70 years or older. And to manage the support of our students and other research programs, for example, this might touch on the engineering sciences at the University of Minnesota, but if we need a new physics building or a new building to teach science, as we're arguing in this legislative session, we would take that through the normal bonding process, and we think we should take it through the normal bonding process, and it should compete with other priorities that are on the table. But I think this is such an extraordinary thing and such an extraordinary investment in the core infrastructure that we need to operate this state and to keep this state on the cutting edge of the biosciences in the future, that it takes a mechanism like this, a more extraordinary mechanism that gives you long-term planning, gives you long-term predictability, and allows you to go out, as Dean Powell has to do each and every day, and recruit the people that are necessary to do this work, Each of these recruits that she talks about takes about an average of two years to complete. I'll be honest with you. The Gunda Georg recruit, 2.5 years, at least, maybe 3 years, will occupy two floors of the old Department of Health building on Delaware to make sure that this new Center on Drug Design has sufficient infrastructure to operate. So these are complex investments, and they do require, I think, a different strategy. And if you use the regular bonding process, I would predict that we will see much more of taking 4 years to get one of these done, taking another two, and then suspending any hiring of people until the building is approved and actually constructed, because no investigator like Linda Georg is going to come here unless he or she can see exactly the kind of support they're going to get. And I'm just saying that's a recipe. The road we're on now is a recipe, in my judgment, for decline. The status quo or decline, and that's not going to be good enough, I think, to keep us and to keep the vibrant biosciences industry strong in Minnesota. And it's a tough one because we have a lot of competing issues on the table, and I understand that. But it seems to us that we need this public discussion and public debate, and we need to make our decisions and live with them.
Okay, I now have 5 members with questions, and we have session at noon, so, boy, I'd really like to get this out of committee today. And we had 4 other bills, and I apologize, we're not going to have time for yours, Representative Cornish. I appreciate your patience. I didn't realize we had session today at noon. We were going to go over, but we need to be out of here within 10 minutes. Representative Laffer, can you make it very quick, please?
Yes, you have pointed out that this is a very big precedent, and it may be one that really marks our career. And I really feel the tradition used to be that government operations was always the last committee that a bill came to in its final form to make sure if it was consistent with other things. This idea, as the presenters have shared, is a new idea. It hasn't had, it's only been introduced less than a week. It hasn't had the review of the bonding committee, whose expertise on this is much greater than most of us on this committee. And I would really respectfully ask that we ask this bill to come back to us. And when it comes back to us, we spend a lot of time on the issues that are our purview in terms of the authority, how people are appointed, how many are on it, because I think we all are going to live with this. And it will be brought up by many others with many other exciting projects, whether there are opportunities to invest in our natural resources or other colleges. So I will ask that our motion be made, include that we ask that the bill come back so we can work on it further.
So noted. Next up is Representative Aaron Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the members at the front of the table. Recently, my Alumni Association has been sending me letters from the University of Washington in Seattle asking me to contribute to what they call the Creating Futures campaign on campus, the $2 billion fund for investment. And I'm wondering, and I'm thinking about the similarities between the schools and the desirable location and the such, and I'm wondering, you know, it's, a lot of it's being put together by Microsoft, Weyerhaeuser, Starbucks, Boeing. Does the U of M, since I'm not an alumni, does the U of M have a similar private, fund that you're trying to raise? And could this, what you're discussing today, be within that mission, or is it outside of the U of M's mission on biomedicine?
President Brunick.
Chair Tinglestad, Representative Peterson. You've raised a very good question. In fact, this initiative is very much an initiative that will focus a good deal of its energy in the biomedical sciences, as I understand it. And Washington is one of the premier centers for research in this area in the world. We have very aggressive private fundraising. In fact, for the medical school, we have a goal of raising $250 million in private support and university internal university contributions over the next few years to support some of the ongoing costs of hiring these faculty, building the core infrastructure to support them, like the equipment that is necessary and so forth. We believe, and you can see this in all the annual reports where foundations and the success of foundations are judged, that we do a very good job in this area. We're always in the top 10 of public research universities around the country, in the company of other universities like Washington and Michigan and others. So that will be very much a part of this. We you cannot get all of the funding and support you need in this area and all the other areas that are important to the University of Minnesota without a very important private fundraising effort. Today, private fundraising contributes about 11% of the total operating annual operating budget of the University of Minnesota. Our plan is to grow that to roughly 15 to 16% over the next 5 to 10 years. But it's a growing part, and it's a growing part of helping us stay competitive in this area. For example, Gundagiard will hold a endowed chair that recognizes her work and helps support her work. That was made possible by a grant from the McKnight Foundation and internal resources of the University of Minnesota. So all of these things have to work together to be successful.
Thank you. No follow-up.
Okay, members. Looking at the time here and knowing that the bill will probably come back to us again, I know Representative Welty, Beard, Kahn, and Demmer all have questions. Perhaps you could talk to Representative Abrams, separate from this meeting, and many of you serve on other committees. This will be going to Representative Kahn to this point.
Exactly. Is the motion going to be the motion as Representative Loeffler suggested?
Yes, we've noted in the minutes that we're going to probably request that this bill come back to our committee, and we'll be working with.
Well, I think it was stronger than that. I think it was the motion that it be recommended to pass, with the recommendation that it come back to the committee at the end. I thought that's what I see.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, that was my intent, that this bill come back just so we can work on the further on the areas that is the jurisdiction of this committee.
Representative Abrams.
I have to be able to understand who's the last committee to see the bill, because you're going to have Representative Knobloch say the Ways and Means Committee, because this is a future obligation, is going to be the last committee. You're going to have Representative Krenke say, because of the tax issue in the bill, his committee is the second to the last committee. I can certainly see why this committee may want to see some aspects of the bill again, but I think that saying that we are going to be the last committee is, and Representative Seifert also will probably have a couple things he's going to want to see in the bill. So I want to know if last means last or last means kind of last.
Kind of.
I think it means again. Representative Kahn, to this point.
Yes, I think the question is when the structure, supposedly then none of those committees are going to muck around with the structure. So when the structure is set up, and we've been told that the structure isn't set up, that was the first thing you said, is that we're going to look at what kind of a fund it comes out of and that sort of thing. So when the structure, you know, when the structure is set up and none of those later committees are going to muck with it, you know, I don't care if it's fourth from the last or, but the bill right now, I think, I'm agreeing with Representative Loeffler, is incomplete for us to pass it at this time. But I also understand that you want to move it on, and I'm sympathetic to that.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm certainly willing to work with you and Representative Kahn, but I guess if you're here long enough, you hear Phyllis Kahn say that we don't want any committees mucking with our work, so we're going to muck with their work. Is that what I hear you saying, Representative Kahn?
Oh, Representative Abrams, you know me well enough to know that I'm a totally honorable person.
I made that point once on the floor.
You
may be devious,
but
he's not dishonest.
Yeah. Representative Beard, you've been patient. Quickly, please.
Thank you. I agree. I think there are some things about the construction of the membership and this board that's going to oversee bonding that we need to settle here. Is it possible just to hold this bill over and take it up first tomorrow, or do we need to take action today?
We have four other bills plus two others scheduled. So
I think the problem is... I would object to that, even though I want to see it again. The problem is these other committees really have to see it, and we don't know what it's going to look like till it gets through those. So I really think it's better to take another look later, because I don't think we'd have any additional information tomorrow morning.
Madam Chair, that's what I needed to understand, the process and a little education there, and we should promise Representative Abrams, if it comes back, we will restrain our remarks and comments to things that we're actually authorized to deal with there. So.
Okay.
We won't take up all his time with all the other stuff.
And I've been discussing this issue with Mr. Shepard. Again, another very unusual motion our committee's never had before. He tells me that the recommendation to go to the next committee is non-binding to that committee, and we're noting in the minutes that we want to see this bill again, and I think there's not really a motion that we could make to do that, according to Mr. Shepherd. So I'd like to work with Representative Abrams, and it's on record now that that's what we'd like to do, and so I think that's all we need at this point as far as a motion with what's going. Representative Abrams.
Madam Chair, I've always found it easier to spend an hour in committee trying to work out a problem than 3 hours on the floor, where it is very difficult to work out an issue. So if members of this committee would like to see this bill again when it's nearer the time for floor action, I would be happy to accommodate.
And we will make sure and make time for you. I should ask the question, is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill, and if you're not able to attend one of the other committee meetings that this will be heard in? Okay, thank you. All right, I'd like to wrap this up. So Chair would like to renew the motion that House File 3268, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and going to higher ed. And with that, members, meeting is adjourned.